Shalom, everyone. I'm Monty Judah with Lion and Lamb Ministries, and welcome to our program. Our program is entitled False Gods and Idols, and in particular, we are going through in this program focusing in on the second and third commandment of the Ten Commandments, where God said, "You will not have any other gods before me, and you shall not make for yourself any idols, any likeness that's after things in the heavens, or on the earth, or on the sea below." And one of the things that I shared with you in the opening is a very intriguing element of the commandment, because when he gives that commandment, he also states that he intends to punish if you don't keep these particular commandments. If you have other gods before God, if you make idols, it says he, God, is jealous, and that's the reason why he's going to punish you, your children, and your grandchildren because of that. Maybe we didn't realize that God really takes this commandment very seriously. And in particular, he evokes and tells us about his character, about his emotion of being jealous about this. I think a lot of people, when we look at this subject and we think about it, we go, well, what's the big deal? I mean, you know, think about it here for a moment. We all know there's only one real God. And all these other false gods, they're all false. They're really fake. They don't really exist. That if you have somebody who has an idol, is just a metal or a wooden thing, it's a thing, and it can't do anything. It has no power. It doesn't have the power of God. And it, no big deal. And, why does God get all upset about that? And as we shared with you in the first program, it has to do with the very nature of who he is. He is the Creator God. And as I shared with you before, according to Spurgeon, who was a great theologian, he said in every person, there's this God-shaped vacuum that seems to be in every person, and we're looking for something to fill that vacuum, and the only thing that's going to fill it correctly is the Creator God, the true God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the true Redeemer. He's the only one that can fill that vacuum for God, the only one you're going to be satisfied with. And God says, I don't want anything in that space with you that isn't me. I don't want you to put another God in there. I don't want to be mixed with another God. I don't want to be mixed with idols. Only me goes in that place with you. And if you put something in there above me, before me, and so forth, I'm going to be very upset with it about it. Now, in the last program, we emphasized on this characteristic about jealousy. Now, a lot of times we'll hear where a statement will be made about a person who's jealous, and sometimes our first reaction to hearing that is, you know, they really shouldn't be jealous. Maybe God shouldn't be jealous. I mean, he's a big God. You know, can't he be bigger than the situation? And that's what we say to others when we say that they are jealous about a certain situation. Hey, you know, rise above that. Be more mature. Stop being jealous about that kind of thing. You know, we poo-poo that emotion a lot of times one another with us. But I would offer counsel to you, do not try to do that with God. He emphatically states this is his position with it. So let's examine a little closer what is the definition of that word jealous that we use. I'm going to use a standard dictionary for it. It's got basically four main definitions that go with the word jealous or jealousy. Number one, jealous is a resentment against a rival, a person enjoying success or advantage, etc., or against another's success or advantage itself. So the jealousy that God has, is it because he sees other gods as rivals to them? And does he see them having more success with you, that they have an advantage with you that he doesn't have, and therefore he becomes jealous, and he sees the success they're having in your life, and he's not being successful in your life? That's an interesting definition. There could be some parts there that God's referring to. You know, he does love us. He has paid the price for us in redemption, and yet we turn around, having acknowledged him and recognizing him for that, we turn around and then we allow other gods and other idols to have success with us in turning us away from God, and he doesn't like that. He sees that as a competition with him. And to a certain extent, I think that's part of the definition of why he's jealous. He doesn't like rivals. He does not like other gods. In fact, he emphatically says, I am the Lord God, there is no other. And when you begin to behave in a following a false god, or you begin to behave in following an idol, you're basically standing up and saying, no, God, you're not right about that. There is another God here. Look at him. And by the way, he's got some attributes and some things I like, and is holding, commanding my attention. I'm going to give some of my praise and thanksgiving over here to it. And apparently that really makes him angry. Let me look at the second definition. Second definition says mental uneasiness from suspicion or fear of rivalry, unfaithfulness, etc., in as in love or aims. And we know the definition of an unfaithful husband or an unfaithful wife, that it evokes jealousy on the part of the other spouse. And we do have a relationship with God in which he's the bridegroom and we're the bride. And Paul talks about how that's the relationship that we have with the Messiah, and that he's a jealous God. And we can certainly understand why an unfaithful spouse, that the other spouse would be jealous in that matter. We don't poo-poo that. We don't look down on that. We say, well, that's sad. That's terrible. Shouldn't be that way at all. And we should follow through and say, you're right. God should not have those feelings, because we shouldn't be having those issues. If we said that we were going to be faithful to God, we should be faithful to God and not draw out his jealousy because we're not being faithful to a God. I shared with you before that idolatry and having false gods is really spiritual adultery. Just as adultery in a marriage would evoke a jealousy on the part of the spouse, the same thing is true for spiritual adultery. God wants to command our full attention. For him being God, he wants us to prefer him above all others. He wants us to seek him out for his protection, seek him out for his blessing, not to go looking for protection or blessings from other places. He also explains to us that it's going to be, it's not going to work out for us. And he's trying to warn us and protect us from those other things. Third definition that you'll get for jealousy is it's a vigilance in maintaining or guarding something. You could say that the person is jealously guarding him, for it. How many of you, let's say you have a house and you live in the town, and how many of you feel about somebody walking in your backyard? They just unannounced, they walk in your backyard, start walking around your backyard. How do you feel about that? Well, if you're like me, I go outside and say, hey, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. Get out of here. And he better have a pretty good explanation about what he's doing there. And he better have said, why didn't you come and ask for permission? Well, the same thing is true on your front yard. You see somebody, I live on a corner house. When I see somebody cut across my yard and not use the sidewalk, that's for where the public goes. When they cut across my yard, you know, I'm jealous for my house, my yard. Hey, do that properly. Don't do that inappropriately. When somebody takes your stuff and uses it without permission, why, you are jealous for those things. You're trying to maintain vigilance and guard over the things that are there and proper. We all look at that as proper things, proper use of the word jealous. And God has the same thing. So let me go ahead and just tell you real briefly, everything that's in this world belongs to God, including you. And he's trying to maintain a vigilant order over to protect all that is his, and you decide to abuse it, misuse it, act on it with regard to it, and guess what? It irritates him. It offends him. He's jealous for those things. That's part of his makeup, being jealous. It includes all of those emotions of protection and so forth for it. And then finally, the fourth definition that we get is jealous is a feeling, it's a disposition, it's a state, or it's a mood. You can be in a jealous mood. You can be in a jealous state. You can be have a jealous disposition. You could have a jealous feeling. In the case of God, based on the way he describes his jealousy, every one of those things are part of the description of how God describes himself. God says, I have jealous feelings. God says, my basic disposition is I'm jealous. I'm warning you. I'm telling you up front, I am a jealous God. I'm in a jealous state. You're not going to move me off. There's not going to be one day where I'm not jealous. I'm going to be jealous every day. I'm in a jealous mood. By the way, do not irritate me with this subject. Do not provoke me with this. You know, God's very emphatic that he said every bit of this is the definition of him. Now, as I said before, sometimes when we hear about somebody being jealous, they're in a jealous mood or a jealous state or they have a jealous disposition, we tend to look at that as that they shouldn't have that. They shouldn't have that mood or disposition. We try to talk them out of it. In the case of God, we don't try to talk him out of it. We just ignore it. We just, you know, we heard what God said about it. We just ignore it. You know, I'm not going to think about that when I think about God. I'm going to think about God's mercy and grace and how he loves me and he's forgiven me of my sins. But that jealous business about God is over. That's not going to cross my mind. I'm going to go ahead and just live my life and ignore that part of his description of how he has described himself. And if you do so, you do at your own peril. And in this particular case, ignorance of his jealousy is not a defense. He's been very emphatic about this. In Exodus 23 and verse 13, he says this, "Now concerning everything which I have said to you, be careful. Do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth." Whoa. That is tough. Let me tell you why that's so difficult for us. The world we live in is full of all kinds of false gods. It's full of idols every which way we turn around. Our kids are exposed to it. We're exposed to it. All the entertainment world is full of it. The sports world is full of it. You can barely do anything in this world that you don't rub up against some version of idolatry and some form of counter-spiritual warfare about some false gods or demons that are going on in this world. And I want to go a little bit further here on God's definition of a couple of things. In Psalms 115, he gives a rather interesting definition about these things. And I want you to listen particularly to the words that he uses for it. Psalms 115, beginning in verse 3, it says, "But our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but they cannot speak. They have eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. They have noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, but they cannot feel. They have feet, but they cannot walk. They cannot make a sound with their throat. And those who make them will become like them, everyone who trusts in them." Wow. You know, the first thing he does is he's pointing out that all idols of different things, they have no abilities. They have no capabilities. But then the punchline, the punch in the gut that comes with this explanation, it says, if you worship those, if you pursue those, you'll become like them. And you will have the same attributes that they have. You ever seen somebody who just is obsessed with the subject of, he's following sports and he's idolizing professional sports. Have you ever seen the guy who gets so involved with it that it's like that's all he is that football, that game, those players, the stats, the figures, the seasons, the history, and he's willfully ignorant of everything else going on in the world. He has no idea what's going on in the world. He's blind to what the world says. He can't hear anything what the world does. Doesn't understand anything about other things. That's his one subject. And that's all it's got. And when that stops, he stops too. He's got nothing left. That's what idolatry can do to you. It will get you so absorbed in that idolatrous thing that you lose sight of everything else around you. Here in a moment, I want to introduce you to what we call idolatrous systems, idolatrous substitutions that people use for God that we have running rampant in the world. And immediately you're going to see this principle that I just expressed to you. They become like them. There's no difference between them and this idolatrous thing that they are done. So let's take one of the first idols that are substitutionary systems for God, humanism. The idea that man cuts his own cloth, he sets his own destiny, everything is based on what men do. It's called humanism as opposed to it's a complete denial of God, and everything is based on the human. It's called humanism. And they become completely devoid of understanding of spiritual things, completely devoid of things having to do with God. And yet at the same time, they're highly spiritual because that's their religion. Humanism becomes their religion. How about this religion? Historism. People who believe in Marxism. People who believe in communism. How about this one for a more recent thing, version of that? How about all the people who believe in the LGBTQ agenda? They believe in it so strongly that everything else grows pale. Or abortion. They believe in that one thing to the exclusion of everything else. They can't process the definition of life in any other way, shape, or form. It's all about that. And in the election cycles, a lot of times those topics will kick up, and that they vote only on the basis of that particular idolatrous system of thinking. That's all they can do. They can't have a broad-based understanding, a balanced understanding of things. How about this one? Evolutionary science. Oh my God, that is a religion for sure. Darwinism has more faith requirements in it than people understand. It's not science, it's a theory. It's an unsubstantiated theory. It's a theoretical theory. And they become so obsessed with it that they dismiss the facts of other elements, such as the creation. They'll literally dismiss hard facts on the earth about creation. One of the latest, by the way, just on that subject, one of the latest things that's come along is there is nothing in this earth, nothing in the creation that exists of its own, that is self-moving, self-motivating. Something, some other force has to act on it to make it what it is. So if you just take everything that exists in the universe, what is the thing that acts on it that makes it happen? Because everything in the creation has a component that does this. Where's the original force that acted on it and made things do what they did? How did we get the creation to begin with? Like when the Bible first starts out and it says, let there be light. What caused the light? By the way, when that light came into existence, time came into existence, gravity came into existence, the small and great nuclear force came into existence, energy came into existence, material things came into existence, all at one moment. Something acted on that and made that happen. What was it that acted on that? That's not evolutionary. That is the word creation. And it's self-evident right there. But, you know, if you get into evolutionaryism, you move away from God, you've got another idol. You got something else in front of God, and they've missed the whole point of what got it all started to begin with. Let's talk about another idolatrous system. Mammon, money. The pursuit of money, hoarding of wealth. You know, pursuing your career, working all your life to get to your retirement and so forth. And you make that above God. And you pursue it. Oh my gosh, how disappointed you are going to be. You ever heard about the people who, oh God, help me, let me win the lottery. When I win the lottery, I get all that money. Oh my gosh, all the good things I can do and so forth. Well, here's the stories of the people that get it. They get it. Are they happy? Does it work out for them real good? No. You see, that's not greater than God. And it's just one of the things that exists in this world, and it's not fully satisfying like God is. And if they put it above God, they lose it. And there are many, many stories of lottery winners that won it and don't have it anymore. You can also see this in people getting inheritances. You know, they're waiting for their family member or whatever to pass so they can get the inheritance. They get the inheritance, and it's gone in 6 months. I always like to tell this one story. There's a kid who, right as he graduated from high school, that he had an uncle or something who passed away, and he was the sole heir, and he received just millions and millions of dollars right as he graduated from high school, and all the kids that were in his class said, oh my gosh, he's starting his life, getting done with high school, starting his life, he's a multimillionaire. Well, it's 10 years later. And this kid shows up at the 10-year reunion. So everybody's kind of scared to walk up and talk to him. You know, they're not quite sure. But one of them finally gets the courage to walk up to him and talk to him. And he says, well, how you doing? And he said, oh, I'm doing okay. And he said, well, what are you doing these days? He says, oh, I'm a cab driver in New York. And the other kid goes, wait a minute, aren't you the kid that got that big inheritance right as you graduated from high school, your uncle died, and you get, he said, yeah, I'm the one. He said, well, didn't you get millions of dollars? And he said, yep, I sure enough did. And he said, well, what the heck happened? I mean, yeah, how come you don't have that anymore? He says, well, you know, the first couple of years I got it, it was wine, women, and song. I mean, I party hardy. I went out and had a good time, you know, and so forth. And the other guy goes, with all of it? You did all of that with it? He said, oh, no, I squandered the rest. And just life will just eat it up in the course of events. It's never going to be satisfying, you know, for it. And that's where the whole pursuit of money turns into an idol to you. You, of course, know that the love of money is the source of all evil, the scripture tells us. When you love money that much, that's where evil springs up in your life. But the pursuit of money is more in the form of idolatry for it. And the whole system that we have of the American dream, make money, own your own house, buy a new car, get your retirement going, and so forth, you use that as a substitute for getting to know God, you're practicing idolatry. And you've made yourself into a false god. You made money a god to you. Here's another one that's kind of interesting, and this one has been cropping up more here of late, if you've been paying attention to current events, and that is the idea that we believe that the state, that our government is the source of all of our blessings and good things that we have, and you believe the government is the one that will solve your problems. And as a result, we believe that all we have to do is legislate a new law. We need to get a president who will execute an executive order and put dictates out. The government bureaucrats will write regulations. And we think we're going to make life better by doing that. And we believe in the government. We trust the government, which is absolute foolishness. But you know what? There's a bunch of people in the world that do believe it. And we have a lot of citizens in our fellow country. This is their idol. They look at the government like it's a god. And they prefer it over the God of the Bible. In fact, if you come in and quote the God of the Bible versus their regulations and their rules and what they think is righteous, they'll dismiss the God of the Bible, dismiss it, and dismiss you for having quoted from God. They don't believe that God has any principles of wisdom that should be appropriate for them. They think the state and the government is more powerful and is wiser and so forth for it. They're all arguing to be able to get control of it. Now, here's another one that is a form that is formed up, and it's called victimhood. We have a lot of people who have been victimized. We have people that are poor. We've always had poor people. We've always had people that have been victimized by different things. But there's a kind of a movement where this victimhood turns into, well, they economically they were victimized, and so we need to help them. And they were racially victimized, and they were oppressed, such as a migrant was oppressed and treated by other people. Or how about this, disabled people and so forth. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't help the poor. Don't misunderstand me. There's clear commandments on that. And I'm not saying that we should not treat men with respect. I don't care what the color, the pigment of their skin is or their stature. I'm not saying that we should mistreat a stranger or an alien or a sojourner. Absolutely not. The Bible teaches emphatically against it. And certainly a disabled person. The Bible is very emphatic that you do not put a stumbling block in front of a blind man and cause him to stumble and fall. God himself will avenge, you know, that person for it. What we're talking about is the idea that we take that whole area and we turn it into our definition of our righteousness. Oh, you see, I care for those people far greater than other people care for, and I'm going to do things even beyond what God has said. My ideas of caring for them are far greater than what God has said, and they literally embellish themselves, and they heap self-righteousness on themselves, and that, too, is a form of idolatry. The last one is called ecumenicalism. This one's going to get really weird. This is where we take organized religion and we say, you know, God has said some pretty stern, specific things, but you know, look, let's, you know, God's really about love. And so let's rise above religious doctrine. Let's rise above what the Bible says. And we're religious people, and let's just let love guide us. And if you're a different person of faith in a different way, how about you and I, we agree that we're still brethren, and we're still going to cooperate with one another, and it's called ecumenicalism. It's a melding and assimilation of all of the different things. The Catholic Church and the Pope has been working on this very seriously for many years, to assimilate with all the other religions, the Muslim religion, Islam, with the Asian religions. You know, he has them representatives come in and he treats them good and talks about how we should all work together. And born out of that is we have within our country where we have this doctrine of, you know, God is love and we should all love one another. And now it's a covering, an excuse for all manner of misbehavior and gross sin. And the homosexual community loves this subject of ecumenicalism because they get to be accepted into the various Christian assemblies. And anybody who would stand up and quote the Bible and say, hey, you know, the Bible says homosexuality is a bad thing and you're not supposed to do it. Oh, let's dismiss that. Let's get that guy out of here. See, he's not being very loving. He's not loving his neighbor. He's lost the sense of, you know, we're supposed to love God and everybody else and all this other stuff. You know, we don't need that. We don't want to get him out of here. And that has turned into their own God, their own form of worship. And it certainly qualifies as idolatry. So what's God think about all that? Well, let me repeat it for you again. He says he's a jealous God. You will not put any of that before me. You'll not mix me with any of that. I'm not going to put up with it. I am who I am. You take me for who I am. And you don't get to reform me or reshape me and turn me into your so-called religion as you practice idolatry. You don't get to ignore me and go off and take things that I've created in the world and turn them into a god for you. That's his position with regard to it. Today, in the world that we have today, we have this phenomenon called social media. I was asked not too long ago, you know, the verse about, you know, the gospel be preached into all the nations, and has that been fulfilled? And I said, well, yes, of course it has. He said, well, how's it been done? I said, well, look at the internet. Look at social media, every country in the world. And to prove my point, take any one of these different idolatrous things. How has it been spread throughout the world? Through social media and the internet, it's spread everywhere. Every nation has these issues. Even the remote nations, they have these kinds of idolatrous systems mixed in with all the other historical forms of idolatry, the historical forms of false gods. They've all been mixed into it. The book of 1 John really deals with the subject of idols. And, you know, John really focuses in. Let me summarize kind of his book a little bit on some of this point. He kind of poses this question that's all going through the book that says, which idol am I trying to make into a god? You know, let's go down and do a little inventory for yourself. Where are my interests at? You know, what do I like? What commands my attention? What do I put my praise and thanksgiving on? Where's the focus of my life? What are the things that are in my life that I do and that I put my energies into? Am I trying to make that into an idol? Am I getting close to that? Am I preferring that over God? Only you can answer that question. But I would recommend that we do a little self-examination about this subject, because, and just from the standpoint of, you know, God has given us fair warning. This stuff provokes me to anger. I will punish when it happens. I will even go so far as to get to your children and your grandchildren with these issues. You better get this right with me, because I am God. I am a holy God. I am the Creator God, and I'm not going to put up with false gods and other things put in front of me. You have to accept him for who he is. If you're not willing to do that, then you're on the wrong side of the ledger with this God. And you're borrowing and taking up space on the earth that belongs to him. So there's no way to escape this. You can't walk away from this question and say, well, I just don't want to deal with this. Now, the moment you do that, you've made your decision that you're going to prefer other things over the Lord. If you really pursue the Lord, if you prefer the Lord, you'll pay attention to what he's saying. You'll take it seriously. Now, I want to do just a very quick review, and this will probably spill into the next program, but I want to review very quickly to you. There are certain false gods that are spoken of in the Bible, and we hear frequently where they come up, and we can see the issues in the biblical record of how they caused trouble for Israel, how they caused trouble for the servants of God, and we have several references where they take place. I pulled together, I'm not going to give you a big comprehensive review on this thing because I don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time on it. And at a minimum, I don't want the names coming off my lips more than is absolutely necessary for you to be aware that the Bible does address this subject. So I'm going to give you a quick list of the basic gods that are listed, false gods that are listed in the Bible, and give you a short definition for each of them. You can get this information. In fact, I'm going to refer to the definition that is a standard definition that comes from other biblical commentaries and so forth. The first false god is the one called Ashtoreth, A-S-H-T-O-R-E-T-H, and also called Astarte, A-S-T-A-R-T-E. The plural is Ashtoreth. And this is a false god, but there's plural of this god, it appears. And this was referred to as the goddess of the Canaanites, who was connected with fertility and maternity. You know, if you want to have good crops, you invoke on God's help. You know, farmers are very spiritual people. They pray to God, hey, God, I need some rain. You know, please cause my crops to grow and increase. You're subject to whatever God does that year and so forth. So they invoke God for it. Also for the bearing of children, fertility. And the worship of Ashtoreth was strong at Sidon. This is the area of the Phoenicians that was north of the coast of Israel along the Mediterranean. She, and this is a feminine god, was sometimes called a consort or a companion of Baal. B-A-A-L. You'll hear about Baal. King Solomon was very much influenced by this god, false god. Some of the wives that he married fell into this worship, which led to King Solomon's downfall. King Solomon was the wisest king of Israel, and yet he was subject to idolatry, and it cost him. And we have the biblical record for it. The other god that I mentioned there was Baal. Baal, sometimes called Bel, was the supreme god among the Canaanites, worshipped in many forms, but usually is considered a sun god or a storm god. And fertility was also a part of what it is, bearing crops and women bearing children. They always looked for that. And the rites involved a cult, prostitution, and sometimes human sacrifice. You know, the idea is you have to give a gift to the god to evoke and get the god to do good things for you. There's this cooperation and praise and so on. They would sacrifice their children, you know, something of great value to get the favor from. This god didn't do any favor, didn't give any favor, they just killed his children. False god, Baal. The third one, is Chemosh, C-H-E-M-O-S-H, who's referred to as the subduer in the Bible. This was the god of the Moabites and the Ammonites. The children of Israel had to deal with this god when they were getting ready to cross into the land. And this is the one that Balaam got involved with. This is the god they worshipped, and the 24,000 died, where the story of Balaam and the story of Phinehas. Solomon got involved with this one too. And in fact, he south of the Mount of Olives, up on a hill, he built an altar to this god, and that's recorded for us in 2 Kings 23, verse 13. Again, part of the downfall of Solomon. The last one is Dagon, a very famous god. He's the Philistine god. Samson dealt with him, and when the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant, they took it to their Dagon thing. And the Dagon statue that they had set up, their image and so forth, suffered destruction and injury because of the God of Israel. And there's stories about King Saul's armor dealing with the Philistines, and Dagon was the big god that they had. Those are four gods, false gods, that we see descriptions. But here's the bottom line on all these false gods. Any involvement with these false gods ends in disaster. The only god that you end up with a blessing is the God of Israel. And these are false gods that came up against, that would try to match up against the testimony of the God of Israel in the ancient times, and we have it recorded in the Bible those instances where that took place. Now, when I come back to you in the next program, we're going to get into some more update. We're going to talk about Egyptian gods. We're going to talk about some Roman gods and Greek gods. And we're going to move into more of the modern time frame of other false gods and idols that we have going on with us that you'll probably recognize even more frequently. So until we get to the next program, shalom to all of you.